music session number 18335, Reel 4.
Ken Lakeman, Reel 4.
Yes. So the engineer's kind of swathed in through the hedge and let the traffic go and the interrupters carry it on. But the things like that were quite upsetting, really. You didn't think of it like that. Somebody's son, I suppose.
Any reception from civilians in Belgium?
Very warm indeed. I didn't get into Brussels, but my first, we were in Liège, in Lierre, and I always remember one dear old lady, who must have been in her 80s, coming up and giving me a kiss and saying, thank you for coming. And she pointed to her house, which had been damaged, not badly, but damaged. In the fracas, and I thought then, well, dear old soul, she's thanking me, and here we are, we've in her dotage, we've nearly put pay to her abode. But they were just very glad to see us, and the reception I got in Antwerp was absolutely fantastic, because I was one of the few British soldiers in there with the Canadians at the time. Our engineer section had gone in there to do lots of rebuilding jobs, you know, quickly. And the people there were absolutely fantastic towards us.
As you went through France and Belgium, did you see anything of the treatment of so-called collaborators?
Yes, we did. A lot of the women had had their hair cut short. And had been branded, you know. And were paraded around and ridiculed.
And branded?
Well, put out, pointed out as collaborators. You know, ridiculed is the word I'm looking for. Ridiculed. And ostracized, I didn't want to know. Yeah. So two or three lots of them. Of course, any quislings, as you were, they'd been marched off. An interrogator, we didn't see them, but I understand there was some.
What did the British soldiers think of such behaviour?
Oh yes, they thought that was bad, very bad. We had no time for them.
What did they think of the shaving and ridiculing of the collaborators?
Well, they thought they got their just desserts, really. They had to be shown to be different from others. And I mean, it wasn't up to us to pass judgment, but obviously their fellow men knew what they'd done and what they'd, how had they been of some assistance to the Germans for them to do that. I suppose there's always a chance that the innocent were those so branded, but then it wasn't up to us to judge. If you're living with people, you usually know their feelings.
Were these collaborators shaved and ridiculed in France or Belgium or both?
Both. Both. Yes.
So you got as far as Liège and Antwerp.
Yeah. And then, of course, there was all the problems there on the Maas, and the flying bombs started to come over then after a while. We were in turnout for a while, building up behind the line in Belgium. And we had a week or two's break there, actually, which was very gratefully received. And then, of course, the winter set in. We all hoped we were going to push forward and get the war over. But it didn't work out like that, and the cold weather came in, and the Germans put in a counterattack, which you all know about. And I don't think I've ever been so cold in my life, ever. The rivers were frozen over. There was very little activity. The occasional shell one way or t'other, you know, from Germany to us and us to them.
Where were you at this time when you were feeling cold?
Place, dear Breda, Breda, Bergen up soon. Turn out near Chateaugenbosch. Bitterly cold. I remember the wireless sets at night. You go out there and you think you're going to be in a tomb. You felt that the doors would freeze over. That's how cold it was. You sit there with your greatcoats on and your blankets around your shoulders. And God, what must it have been like for some of the infantrymen out in the open? God only knows. We did at least have a bit of protection from the vehicle.
Were the Dutch any different from the French and Belgians?
No, they were very, very friendly, very affable. Yes, I must say, generally speaking, I had a great admiration for all three, knowing what they suffered and how they had to cope with it all. And, of course, there was time to make more friendships. I've got friendships which still survive today from some of these people. In fact, I'm going over in September to see some.
To the Netherlands?
Yes, yes. Yes.
Were they in Breda and Chateaugenbosch?
Yeah, the particular ones I've got to see are further up near, between Nijmegen and Eindhoven, a place called Beck. And a particular friend through one of my Canadian Royal Signals friends, Morley Young of Ottawa in Canada, he knew her, I didn't, but she was a resistance leader who since the war has devoted all her life to tracing unknown graves. And particularly she's done ever so many of RAF people that have been shot down and couldn't be traced. But through a lot of patient work, research, you know, numbers on engine bombers, the odd dog tag when it's been found, bombers that were well off course. People said it can't be such and such a plane. And they've discovered it and proved beyond all doubt that it was such and such a Wellington bomber that had landed, you know, never returned. So Margot did a lot of good work. She was a school teacher, and she used to help out with the children in the hospital. But she did, she stole a lot of bandages and iodine and medical supplies and worked it way back through. She had a brother who was unfit for military service, and he took part in the Dutch resistance. But she said, you didn't know that. She said, you never ask questions, because what you don't know, you can't tell. But her brother would just say, I'm going away for a few days. And she never asked where or with whom or why. But she told me a story of a village near them. And you must appreciate that they're only 14 miles from the German border where she lived. And, of course, pre-war, they'd intermarried and mixed. They had cousins and in-laws. And it must have been very, very difficult for them, because there's good and bad in every race, I suppose. But in this particular village, they had a German detachment there who treated them pretty well. And this went on for quite a while, and relationships were distant, but they respected each other as long as the curfews were observed and they behaved themselves. And then there was a change. To what degree, I'm not certain, but I think it was a change in the commandant. And certain laws were laid down and they resented it, especially having had a bit of lassitude. And somebody started, first of all, just letting down German vehicle tires and stuffing potatoes up the exhaust to just make it a nuisance to themselves. And they were threatened that if you do this, you'll be punished. You know, we'll extend the curfew and things like this. And then somebody foolishly or otherwise put a wire across the road and decapitated a German dispatch rider. Well, of course, that was a real hero, and God, they were threatened with everything. Then on the other side, a Dutch girl was raped. And the local population felt that there wasn't enough effort made to find out the culprit. And the Germans even annoyed them further by suggesting that it was a Dutchman and not a German that had done it. But I gather that things got from bad to worse. And then eventually the commandant called them all together and he said, if there's any more of these atrocities, he called them, he said, we will take severe reprisals. And they did something else which, I forget exactly what it was, but in his eyes it was an atrocity. So he lined the whole village up, and there was 120 odd of them. And of course they were either very, very old people or very, very young people. And they took, I think it was 1 in 20, and shot them. And they'd just go along the line, and 11, 12, 13, 17, 18, 19, 20. And it'd be an old lady of, say, 70. And the next 20 would be a babe in arms. And they had to lie on the square overnight. Now, that's a story I've been told. How true it is, I don't know, but it's probably in the Dutch archives.
Did you go into Germany the following year?
Yes, I did, yes.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, well, I followed up through. By this time, we had become part of the 21st Army Group and had all sorts of signals duties then. And I had spent time in places such as Bergsteinfort, Munster, where we handed over the town to the Americans. And I had one instance there which, looking back, I'm not terribly proud of. Although I must say I was congratulated wholeheartedly at the time. Having arrived in Munster, they apparently turned a lot of the animals out of the zoo because they couldn't afford to feed them, didn't have the money to feed them, so they had to be all disposed of. But the Munster hospital was in a very poor state of repair. It had been bombed by us, by the bombers, the RAF, or Americans, I'm not sure which. And before we handed over to the Americans completely, we had to put the Munster Hospital into communication again. And when I looked at their switchboard exchange, I've never seen such a mess all my life. I'm not a linesman by trade. And to me, you just didn't know where to start. There was all this equipment, you know, and it was all damaged and lines all over the place. The German staff were still there trying to repair it, give them their due. And I was horrified to be told by one of my senior officers that we had to get this equipment ready in 48 hours. How you do it, he said, I don't care. Do it. So I did the only thing I thought practical to do. I rounded up the German staff there. And there's a dear old boy called Herr Berlin. Never forget him. And he must have been well into his 60s. And he spoke a bit of English. And I just had one or two words of German. And I got him understood. First of all, I said, I want your name and address. Where you live. Got all his records. Got all the records of the staff. Got all the staff lined up. There was about 10 or 12 of them, male and female. Mainly very old, because others were in the forces, you see. And I got their names and addresses. And I said, we want this equipment working tomorrow, or else. And I threatened them. And I detailed my staff to take them home and bring all their belongings back. I said, you stay here until it finishes. Well, when we did this, their family thought they were going to be taken away for execution. And it was quite a... They were protesting violently. I wouldn't have any argument. I made them come. the whole lot. And I put a guard on them. And there they stayed. And they got that exchange done in 48 hours. I wouldn't have had a clue how to do it, neither did any of my... And I don't suppose it was quite so brutal when you think about it, but they worked non-stop for 48 hours. And if they eased up, we stood up, you know, rifles at the ready, which is a, you got 2 hours.
Where was this exchange?
This is at Munster, Munster Hospital. And they did it. And of course, when it was over, we were there actually a week. We said 2 days, but the Americans didn't take over for another 4 or 5 days, so they had ample time. And we delivered them back to their houses, you know, in a civilized, nice manner, if you like. And God, weren't their families relieved to see them? I believe they thought they'd seen the last of them. And as I said, I'm not very proud of that part of it, because I can imagine what they thought, but they were, it had to be done.
What month would that have been in?
I should think it would be about March or April, just before the war ended. And I was on Lüneburg Heath when the war ended. We passed by Celle, and of course we knew of Belsen, but I wasn't allowed to go in, not being medical corps. They wouldn't let anybody in that wasn't medical or associated with the liberation of it. But you could... sense something was going on, put it that way. I remember seeing some of the better ones coming out on railway trucks with their pajamas, as I call them, on their stripes. And when I see youngsters today wearing shirts like that, it goes through me like a knife. Like a knife. And these men were the fittest. I mean, they looked like death warmed up. Men and women on these trucks, coming down with guards, taking them back to be deloused and checked medically, you know. Terrible. And I was fortunate enough, I was on the Lüneburg trials, sending back information for press in Great Britain, where the press people were out. The war was over in May. As you know, Montgomery signed it, the treaty. And the Lüneburg trials were brought right afterwards. And
who was being tried?
The commandant there at Belsen and his lady friend Irma, the witch. And they would walk through Lüneburg or come out of the vehicles, walk into the courtroom, you know, bold as brass, heavily guarded. Heavily armed guard. And we talked to the local people that were tried to, and they denied all knowledge of this going on. And I couldn't see how it was possible. I mean, that camp isn't very far from Lüneburg and from Celle. And how they can... It's rather like saying something's going on at Newton Abbott, and we didn't know there was a concentration camp there for 4 years. That, I find... unbelievable. But they swore blind that they knew nothing about it. They were innocent, you know. And then one of the German leaders, I'm trying to think which one it was now, committed suicide while we were there in Lüneburg. He took a pill. I'm trying to think which one it was now. One of the lesser hierarchy, but... the rumour went round that one of them had managed to get a cyanide tablet, which he had. It wasn't Himmler, but it was one of the... I think he went in the bunker, but it was one of the smaller ones. And then from there, we were sent up to Schleswig-Holstein in the, near the Danish border on some rehabilitation work. I don't quite know what it involved, because I was only involved in the signals work. But of course, everything then was getting no cipher. We stopped cipher. The war was over, and everything was RT. So you did know a bit what was going on, but I think our purpose there was just rounding up and sorting things out. I know I just...
Rounding up whom?
Well, I mean, people looking for deserters and what have you, looking for Germans and just checking up and helping the military authorities. I did go through Hamburg, which was pretty badly damaged, but I had no real knowledge of the place. Just spent 2 or 3 days there. And you could tell they'd done their job there all right, getting in, yeah. One or two of my friends had got into Kiel, and they said that was a revelation. The place I was recalling, the two places actually, one was Ham, where the railway station, of course, which I was naturally interested in, being a railwayman, and to see great locomotives standing up on edge in the railway lines, just like pencils, you know, fantastic. But then the other thing that impressed me was we went into Wuppertal, where the overhead railway was working perfectly. And I thought, God, what a difference, and what a wonderful idea. And couldn't some of our cities today do with an overhead railway like that? They tell me it's still going today. I've not been back to see. But again, that's great foresight by Hitler, if you like, or the Germans. I mean, not just trams, but a part of an overhead railway. First one I'd ever seen.
Did you mix with the Germans at all?
No, fraternization was forbidden at the time, but gradually we had to work with some of them, and we intermingled, but there was that frigid feeling.
Did you obey the non-fraternization order?
Yes, by and large.
What was your attitude towards the Germans in those days?
Firm. We wanted to show the respect which we didn't think they'd given a lot of our people, but we let them know who was the boss, sort of business. There's no question of fraternization to the extent of black market cigarettes or anything like that. Some people did, but we didn't. We frowned on that.
Did you have any contact with the Russians?
Very briefly. We met up with the first Russian detachment. They came into Lüneburg after the peace treaty was signed. And frankly, I found them very unfriendly. I wasn't a bit enamored. There was only a detachment of 30 or 40 perhaps. And we tried to make conversation and exchange cigarettes and things like that. And didn't find them particularly friendly at all. But we were damn glad to see them. Yeah. So different from the Poles, because I'd spent some time with a Polish division. And I thought they were wonderful people. And it's... very hard to imagine, you know, close proximity, Poles, Russians, whatever, Czechs, that could be so different. But the Poles I had a high regard for.
Why were they so good?
They were good soldiers and good comrades, and we seemed to get on very well together. Possibly if another war broke out, we'd get on a bit better with the Russians, I don't know. Difficult to say.
So you were up on the Danish border until demobilization?
No, I can't. They sent me back, and I only got as far as Hanover. I always wanted to get to Berlin. But when I got to Hanover, I was told I was posted back to England. And I was going abroad again to the Far East. And that really upset me. Having done, 4 years, to think I had to go back and then go to the Far East. It really did get to me. And for the first and only time in my life, I got drunk. My detachment packed all my kit, and like this, I said I had a report by 9 o'clock next morning. This jeep would come to pick me up and take me somewhere to fly back to England. And we went out and had a few drinks, and I drank some of this 95% proof potato wine, German potato wine. And I can't remember much about it. And to this day, I can't drink gin. But next morning, apparently, I made myself quite a nuisance. I'd attacked some of my best friends and done a lot of damage, which is unbelievable because I'm not a violent man by any means. And they said to me, well, we've packed all your kit. And I said, well, what's the matter with your eye? They said, well, you ought to know you did it. Why have you got a split lip? And I went, well, you know, ask yourself. And all my knuckles and everything. Oh, I was in a hell of a state. And ironically, the jeep that came to pick me up was an officer in it I knew, Lieutenant Skeletor, great fellow. And he took one look at me, he said, Jesus Christ, he said, what's happened to you? I was, you know, eventually they had to overpower me. They say it took 4 men to hold me down. And I find it hard to believe. But that's it. I was really fighting. So despondent, you know, so upset. Why me? Out of all this lot to go back. Anyway, they flew me from Hanover back to Norfolk with Lieutenant Skeletor. And we were posted then to a holding battalion near London. I forget where it was. And the next day, I went up to a place called Castle Eden in County Durham. And they were reforming this unit, or forming a unit, for the second air support signals. And I was promoted then to sergeant. And the majority of these lads were new lads that had just been called up in 1943, 44, 45. Some of them had only done their basic training, you know. And then gradually we had a sprinkling of, if you like, World War II veterans that were coming back with me. And we sailed. We did a lot more training, about a couple of months training, and we had a good leave, of course. And we sailed from Liverpool on a troop ship called the Orbita. And it was a very old boat, and apparently it had been sunk in the Dead Sea, in the Red Sea, and lifted again and redone and refurbished and put into troop ship. And I was very unhappy about this, going out to the Far East. But